it can happen to you if you're young at heart.
Good evening and welcome to Older Women Live on CKUT at 90.3 FM. I'm Rosemary Wally, your host for today. Our show is on the air once a month, the second Wednesday, from 6 until 7 p.m. We're feminist radio from an elderly perspective. On November the 11th, we commemorate the soldiers killed in the First World War, although no one knows exactly how many there were. And then there were the huge civilian deaths as well. In the space of 4 years, from July 1914 to November the 11th, 1918, around 40 million people died. And people continued to die for years and years afterwards. Today, as we do every November, we're going to be looking at Canada's role as a military power. We have as our guest Martine Eloi, the spokesperson for Échec à la guerre, a local group. For the second half of the show, we'll be hearing from Brisna Kajero on the heroic struggles of the Guatemalan people to defend their electoral choice, Bernardo Arevalo and colleagues, who won the national election on the 23rd of August 2023, and they're supposed to take their place in January to govern the country. Probably most of us think of our Canada as a beautiful place, full of pine forests, lakes, and lots of space. This is our Canada, but there's a darker side to our country, and this is what we're going to be looking at today. Canada has a small population. We're around 39 million people. We're the 38th largest country in terms of people. So why are we up there in terms of weapons sales? We are a major exporter of weapons, the 17th largest exporter. But there's so much we don't know because it's shrouded in secrecy. A lot of our equipment glides across the border to the US with no information available to the public. To look at this issue, we're joined by Martine Eloi, spokesperson for the local group, Échec à la guerre. Thanks for joining us, Martine.
My pleasure.
You and I don't know each other, but we know each other by sight from endless peace demos, rallies, vigils, etc., that we've both attended over the years. How and why did you get involved in the first place?
Well, certainly, probably my family history is partly an explanation for that. Both my grandparents were involved in the First World War, and one of the two was injured during the war and was never able to work for the rest of his life. He was like in his early 20s when he was injured. And then during the Second World War, both my parents again were living in Paris. And when the German troops entered Paris, a part of the population decided to flee to the south of France, which was free territory. So my mother, I've heard the story all through her life, in spite of the fact that when I see what people today are going through, it seems that hers was not such a terrible story, but still, she had to leave at the age of about 20 when the German troops came in. They decided to leave, and they just went down the road with a small knapsack and a few things to chew on their way. And they just walked on the roads towards the south of France, not knowing where they were going, when they would come back, should they be able to ever come back, should the people that they've left behind, should they ever be able to see them again. So my mother passed away at the age of 92, and until then, she kept remembering those very sad days. So war, although I was lucky not to experience it myself, was part of my childhood background, I would say.
So obviously, if you come from those backgrounds, you continue to be involved. So I was involved from a very, very young age. And then when I was about 14, 15, 16, there came along the Ban the Bomb campaign. Well, I was all for banning any bomb. And so it was from there that I was involved. So that's, you know, I don't know, quite a while ago.
I didn't mention that I was also... I was in university when there was the big Ban the Bomb campaign. And then in the 80s, there was a coalition to make Montreal a nuclear-free zone.
Once involved, always involved. Huh? Can we move on now a little bit and talk about Canada's military, which we don't often talk about at all? People don't think that we're a country that produces weapons, and we do en masse.
True. Well, Canada is definitely active in the arms trade, despite the fact that Canada signed on to the arms trade treaty in 2019, which stipulates that state party shall not authorize any transfer of conventional arms if there is knowledge that the arms or items would be used in attacks directed against civilians, or civilians protected as such. Or other war crimes as defined by international agreements. So Canada was actually instrumental in the adoption of this treaty. But then Canada has been exporting light armored vehicles to Saudi Arabia.
Absolutely.
Although there is no evidence that such vehicle, there was evidence, sorry, that such vehicles were used in Yemen. Stunningly, in 2020, arms exports to Saudi Arabia accounted for over 75% of Canada's non-US military exports. And the Collectif Échec à la Guerre that I work with has joined up with various groups, including Labour Against the Arms Trade, Amnesty International Canada, and Plowshares, to pressure the Canadian government to stop exporting light armored vehicles to Saudi Arabia. But we're still waiting for a positive response from the government on this issue. We haven't given up, but the positive response is not coming. The Arms Trade Treaty also prohibits the transfer of arms in the case of war crimes, as defined by international agreements. And last April, Vice President, Minister and Minister of Finance, Chrystia Freeland, reported that Canada had promised to grant a total of $8 billion to Ukraine since the beginning of the war, including equipment and, of course, 21,000 assault rifles, 38 machine guns, and over 2.4 million additional munitions to Ukraine. So according to Canada's annual report on military exports, Canada has exported $20 million in military goods to Israel in 2022, of which a significant portion is related to military aircraft or categorized explosive or such related components. So Canada has maintained its arms shipments to Israel in, we don't know whether Canada has maintained its arms shipments to Israel in 2023, but we have no reason, unfortunately, to think that they have been suspended. We will not know if such components have been incorporated into Israel's recent airstrikes against civilians in Gaza. So I don't think that most Canadians, actually, as you were saying, Rosemary Wally, that Canadians realize that Canada is actively involved in fueling wars.
Well, no, I'm sure they don't. I'm sure they don't. You know, you look around and everything is so beautiful in Canada. So I'm sure that they really don't. But I think that in the last 4 weeks, I think 10,000 Palestinians have been killed in the most brutal manner by having bombs and stuff dropped on their heads from 35,000 feet. I mean, this is terrible. And would you think I was right in thinking that these weapons are getting more and more stronger and stronger, that more and more powerful?
Well, definitely. Like I've seen articles that compare the power, of course, of nuclear weapons that have multiplied by something like 20 or even more the destructive powers of the Hiroshima bomb. So not only are we producing more weapons, but we are producing weapons that are more and more deadly.
Do you have any, I'm assuming that you don't, you and Sheikh Alagher, do you have any ideas of what we can do to move the population towards thinking in terms of weapons and nuclear weapons, everything, and protesting? Because there's no real peace movement here.
Yes, well, I firmly believe that we do have, as citizens, as civil society, that we do have some power. And one example is how we mobilized to oppose the invasion of Iraq by the United States in the beginning of the century. We were in Montreal, in Quebec. We were 250,000 out on the streets at the largest demonstrations, but for 3 months it was between 100,000 and 200,000 roughly in several demonstrations. So it didn't prevent the war, unfortunately, but it did, I think, have an influence on the fact that our government was never openly in war, in part of the coalition in the war. I do believe, as I was saying, in some cases, for example, if you take Afghanistan, we never saw the destruction, the deaths, the images of children and so forth. In the case of the war in Afghanistan, we didn't see those because they were probably not allowed by the American government that wanted this to look like a coalition of the willing to export democracy and protect women's rights. So we have to learn to sort of make an effort to go and get information from various sources in order to have a more accurate picture of what is really happening. We see that when people get a more accurate picture, I was always struck when the small Syrian boy on the beach, remember the small Syrian boy that was found dead?
Yes, the dead body, yes. I mean, that really galvanized people.
Just that picture made all sorts of people react to this is inhuman and so forth, and want to help, want to oppose what was happening there. So in the same way, I think we, in other cases, we don't have this kind of information and it's more difficult to mobilize. But I've been struck, as I said, by the scope of the war propaganda. And if we wonder if this is an exaggeration, just remember that a New York Times journalist lost his accreditation in Ukraine. For what, do you think? For denouncing Zelensky or high officials? No. For simply quoting a soldier as saying, "I hate this war." That gives an idea of how wide-ranging the war propaganda is when a journalist loses his accreditation just for quoting a soldier that hates the war, which seems to be quite normal. Then there are things such as the U.S. strongly condemning war crimes committed by Russian forces in Ukraine and asking that Russia be brought before the International Penal Criminal Court, rather, which is warranted. But then unconditionally supporting Israel and not making any mention of war crimes or bringing this before the International Criminal Court. So there are... there are things which are quite striking. Then there's a statement, I believe it was President Biden, condemning North Korea for transferring weapons to Russia, while for the year 2022 alone, U.S. military provided $20 billion and many arms shipments to Ukraine. Such a double standard is just flabbergasting.
Anyway, what we were talking about, the effects of weapons on the environment.
It's a very serious issue, and it's not one that we usually think of. Of course, war is destruction, it's destruction of human lives, so we tend to think about that, and that's really important. But it's important also to know what all the other effects of wars are. So for one thing, Ukraine and Russia were big producers of wheat. But since the war in Ukraine, this fertile land is being trampled by tanks and bombings and so forth. So there's a lot of contamination going into the soil is becoming contaminated. There's no question of being able to produce the wheat in these conditions. So, for example, the World Food Program used to receive 30% of its wheat from Ukraine, and because of the war in Ukraine, it hasn't been able to provide that. So the World Food Program is in very great difficulty. And according to the World Food Program, 60% of famines in the world are war related. So that's just one aspect that we don't tend to think of. Then there's all the contamination of the various bombs and various chemicals that go into the munition industries. And as a matter of fact, there are there are still people in Vietnam that are women in Vietnam that are giving birth to children that have that are experiencing the consequences of the toxic materials used during the war in Vietnam. So that's like two levels, all the contamination, the health issues, and the production of food and the loss of fertile land and the destruction of the biodiversity in all these regions that are being bombarded. And then there's also the effect on the climate, more directly speaking, for example, on the production of greenhouse gases. And this at several levels. At one level, there's the the military bases that are built. So like there are over 800 military bases in 150 countries. Another thing.
Yeah, that's just American bases.
Bases. And that's another thing that we don't usually stop to think about. But just building these bases, upkeeping them, heating them in itself produces a certain quantity of greenhouse gases. Then there are the wars as such. Waging the wars will produce all sorts of greenhouse gases. There's the production of weapons and munitions. These are highly, they produce high quantities of greenhouse gases. And then during wars, there's often the targets of some bombings are the refineries or tanks that contain oil and so forth that are another source of contamination. And then once you've destroyed all these structures. Within the pipes and the aqueducts. Do you say that in English? Aqueducts. Then you have to rebuild those, and you need cement, and cement is a high producer of greenhouse gases. So there are at least these six areas related to war that we don't stop to think about, but that produce enormous quantities of greenhouse gases. And then the wars themselves require a lot of huge quantities of fuel, which has to be extracted and refined before it can be used by the military as fuel for the tanks or all the other military.
Oh, the fighter jets, yeah.
Jets and airplanes and so forth. You also have to take consideration the gases produced by the military industries in the United States. In the United States, for example, approximately 15% of all greenhouse gases produced are produced by the military. This, if you are interested in this, there's a lot of interest of very interesting figures and information in the Cost of War project. Sorry.
So it's called the Cost of War Project.
Cost of War Project, it's called. In Canada, the National Defence is the body which produces the most greenhouse gases in the country. Again, something which we don't really know. And for a long time, all the production of greenhouse gases by the military were not taken into account in the total production of greenhouse gases in different countries. Canada... military production, but military activity produces as much greenhouse gases as 200,000 cars in a year. Then, of course, I've talked about Canada and I've mentioned a few figures for the United States, but there are all the other countries that are related in that are involved in one way or another in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria. And then once wars have destroyed all the structures and the buildings and the housing and so forth in a country, well, you need to reconstruct. And reconstruction will require a lot of cement. And cement, we know, is an important producer of greenhouse gases. As I said, the Kyoto Accord in 1997 exempted the countries from reporting on their greenhouse gas emissions for defense and security. And it's only in 2016 that the Paris Agreement corrected this and obliged them to report. However, they don't have to include what they've reported when they set the targets for lowering greenhouse gases. So it's a half victory. They have to report how much they've produced, but they don't have to include it in the total of their country. And so just in a quick overview of the fact that we are concerned by the climate, and it's a concern of importance for human survival, but we rarely think of the effects of war on the environment and on the
Exactly. People think of greenhouse gases or whatever, but they don't think of war. Yes. Yeah. They think of butterflies, but they don't think of war. Yes, exactly. Well, thank you very much for talking to us about this, Martine Eloi. Can you just give us a quick couple of minutes about Échec à la guerre, the group that you're part of, that you're the spokesperson for?
I'm one of the spokespeople for Échec à la guerre. Well, quickly, it's important to know that Collectif Échec à la guerre has just celebrated its 20th anniversary. We were set up in 2002. We originally were created in 2002 out of a small group of various organizations. There were faith-based groups, women's groups, international solidarity groups, unions that were worried about the possibility of having another war in Iraq and decided to mobilize. So it started with a small group, but it grew really rapidly to 75, 100 and up to 200 organizations that were part of this coalition. We're still a coalition. We're not simply a small local group as such. We're a coalition of various groups throughout Quebec. And we try to keep track of what's happening around the world, but mainly in wars that Canada, our country, is involved in, because we believe that as citizens, we have some role to play in pressuring our government to withdraw or to not pursue certain wars. Let me just also say that we have each year what we call a White Poppy campaign. We usually start the campaign at the end of February on International Peace Day. And then we stop on the 11th of November, which is the Remembrance Day. Now, the White Poppy is a symbol of the fact that we must remember not only soldiers, but also all the civilians that have lost their lives at war. And every year we have had silent vigils on the site of the official ceremony on Remembrance Day in the memory of the horrors of the war, so that we could make sure that such horror would never happen again. However, in the years that followed, became a ceremony in honor of soldiers. And I'm all with the families that have lost a dear one fighting the war, But we must remember that there are also lots of civilians who have lost their lives in wars, and the percentage of civilians has been rising drastically with modern warfare. And especially, we believe that we must do everything we can to prevent future wars and to stop the destruction. So after a decade of silent vigils in the memory of all victims of war on the site of official Remembrance Day ceremony, we decided to organize an alternative ceremony, including poems, music, songs, art, and thoughts about war and peace. We need to mobilize for negotiations to put an end to the war in Ukraine and for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, as well as an end of the many other violent conflicts in the world. It is a free event next Saturday, November 11th, at 2 p.m. at the Osgag Plaza, 6524 St. Hubert Street, 2 minutes away from St. Hubert Metro Station. And let me just say that if you have missed this because you didn't have a pen available to jot it down, just go to the website echecalaguerre.org, and you'll have the information there about the remembrance, the alternative Remembrance Day ceremony, as well as our email address and telephone number if you want more information. So thank you very much, Rosemary.
Well, thank you very much, Martine Eloi, for speaking to us today.
This is something special for you.
Peace, this is Brother Afro Bambaataa on CKUT Radio, the radio station that's going to blow your mind and give you the soul power, make you move, get crazy. You better be ready. Rah, 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 rah.
Craving bold films that renew the language of cinema?
For exclusive access to the most stimulating and diverse visions of documentary cinema, RIDM is the festival not to miss.
From November 15 to 26 in Montreal.
Go to RIDM.ca to find out everything about the festival's program.
The Montreal International Documentary Festival, where all stories meet.
Good evening. This is Bris Nakasha Rowe. I am a member of Older Women Live, OWL, Collective CKUT 90.3 FM. We produce a radio program every second Wednesday of each month. Tonight, on the second half of the program, we continue our discussion about the situation in Guatemala that we have carried out on since our June radio show. To remind you about it, on the one hand, Guatemala has a predatory ruling elite in government. And on the other, people rejected the criminal system in place by electing an anti-corruption party during elections in August 2023. To continue this discussion, we invited Maritza Urrutia as a guest tonight. Maritza, welcome to our show. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself, please?
Okay, Brisna, thank you for the invitation. As you said, my name is Maritza Urrutia. I live in Holland in this moment for several years. I've been part of the International Solidarity Network with Guatemala because for me it's very important to continue my relation with my country. I'm going to try to talk a little bit about me, why also is my relation in this situation in Guatemala. In 1992, I beat forced disappearance during the conflict in my country. And this have a very hard experience about me. What happened to me and my family, we suffer a lot. And I try to, this kind of things, never forget. And also, if you are a little bit interested, there is a book about what happened to me that the name is To Save Her Life. And is the author is Daniel Saxon.
Thank you very much. So you are a survivor of the internal armed conflict, and we are honored to have you on our show. I have a few questions for you. After 69 years of military-backed, corrupt, exploitative, and criminal governments, Bernardo Arevalo, son of ex-president Juan José Arevalo, and Karin Herrera, both from Semilla Party, were elected president and vice president on August the 20th with over 60% of the vote, meaning that they got more than 1.5 million votes over the party that got second place. With the election of the Semilla Party, people see little and little opening that could begin a process of ending systematic exploitation, repression, corruption, and impunity, and building a democratic country, one governed by the rule of justice. However, the situation is complicated, and current Attorney General Consuelo Porras has been criminalizing judges, prosecutors, lawyers, journalists, human rights defenders, and all political opponents, social leaders, abusively using the state institutions and bias spurious criminal prosecutions. The public ministry and some co-opted judges release people from jail that were already sentenced for committing crimes of corruption and impunity, and also war crimes during the internal armed conflict. And in short, these criminal elites are trying to overturn the results of the elections by having in process a coup d'etat. As a result, people began demonstrating on the streets, and a resistance was formed. So, Maritza, could you tell us who are the people in resistance and why are they in resistance at this moment?
Okay, thank you for the question. It's very interesting because this is a special moment in Guatemala right now. That beginning exactly 25 of June of this year. And we hope we can have a good ending in January 14. The people who's leading now the movement of protest in Guatemala against what the corrupt allies, is the 48 cantones. They are from Quiches nations, and also several ancestral authorities nations that they are leading this movement against, how do you say, this corrupt group that don't want to Semilla took the Bernardo Arevalo the
take
seat
office.
Yeah, the office, sorry. Mm-hmm. These groups are working, they are leading this movement, but also the civil society organization in different parts of the Guatemala, they are protest together and took the streets, the highways, the open spaces in Guatemala, and create a very special movement that never in my history happened before. And this is a very peaceful movement. They are in the street also show resistance, have the actions made cultural, they sing, they manifest the idea with hope that we can change, we can do the things in different ways.
Okay, thank you. Yes, I agree with you, Maritza, and I find it really inspiring, as you said, how these ancestral authorities are leading the movement with such high spirit of joy and music and poetry and all that. And I also find it really interesting that for the first time, as you mentioned, we have the mestizos that were demonstrating in cities, but then, and while the indigenous nations were observing, and then how they decided to participate, and it was by 48 cantones, the 48 communities from the Quiché Nation that called on a meeting, and all the other ancestral authorities joined and decided to occupy the highways. That gave the movement a lot of force, a lot of strength, and we are really hopeful that it is going to last for a long time. And also the fact that they are indigenous people, they have different ways of organizing. They go from the bottom up, and they are elected by general assemblies and not by the corrupt, they are not appointed by the corrupt government. So thank you so much for that, Maritza. I have...
Sorry. I want to express also that what makes also special this movement mm-hmm. is like also a lot of women for the communities. They are part of this protest. They are talking loud about the experience that this is resistance is not beginning 25 of June. This is for decades. Yeah, for years, for several years, they show that, yeah, that the experience of the resistance they give now to the other people in the country. And these women are not anymore only the woman to care the children or make food. They are leader. They speak in front of the public, and there are thousands of people in the street and the highways, and they became and speak louder. This is also another a very important something that is shown in this process for Guatemala.
Yes, excellent. I agree with you that it's not just males. There are females participating. And I think it's because indigenous people have inspired many, many different groups and organizations. I mean, indigenous people have resisted for 500 years. They are ready to resist for as long as it is necessary to make the situation change in Guatemala.
Yo le quiero dedicar esta canción a un doctor que yo adoro porque me ha salvado el día de hoy, a mi doctor Nayib. Andan mal los catarros, ¿eh? ¿Cuántos traen tos? Ah, ¿verdad? Esta va para todo aquel y aquella que ande sufriendo de amor. Ya me canso de llorar y no amanece. Ya no sé si maldecirte o por ti rezar. Tengo miedo de buscarte y de encontrarte.
ahora tus amigos que te vas. Hay momentos en que quisiera mejor hablarme.
Have another question for you, Maritza. So under these difficult circumstances that this resistance is taking place, what are the challenges that they are facing or that they have to face so that Bernardo Arevalo and Karen Herrera take office in January 2024? And that are really able to achieve their dream of a democratic society?
Well, yeah, this is from here to January and after January.
Yes.
No, it's going to be a big challenge, no? Because even now the government and the corrupt a group around them, they try to stop this change, that this hope that the people try to maintain, yeah, through the Bernardo Arevalo and Karen Herrera. It is a several process that is right now are in the Guatemala courts and the Congress to try to stop this process. There is only the resistance of the people are going to stop. We hope stop all what they want to create to avoid Bernardo being president, the next president in Guatemala. And good things that I feel it is, even all these obstacles, the people have hope because they relate Bernardo with the past. Bernardo is a son of the first president in Guatemala. I don't remember Arevalo, the name of the father right now.
Juan José Arevalo.
He was the first president in Guatemala during the revolution in 1944. And in that period, the father of Bernardo Arevalo, he created a lot of programs to help people in education and health system. And in Guatemala, we call it La Primavera, the spring of the only 10 years of spring of history. And that's from 1944 and 1954. And I think even all the problems that we have, we try to remember that period. And we hope even they going to do all we could. The people at their speak, the movements, the indigenous, the 48 cantones, the ancestors, authorities, they said, no, we need to work together. We need to keep to save the democracy, even or fragile democracy. We need to maintain, to try to continue to create another nation.
Yes, thank you. I agree with you that in spite of the fact that all the institutions of the government are co-opted by the corrupt and criminal elites, and that anything, as you said, that is presented to the institutions to have some kind of resolution to prevent the corrupt from continuing the coup d'etat, it doesn't really get any results. But so we don't have the institutions. But as you said, what we have is the people in resistance that are willing to resist because they have the memory of the democratic period in Guatemala, the only democratic period from 1944 to 1954. The spring. So people are really ready for a second spring. And that's what it's inspiring people to continue this struggle. What do you think we need to really continue with this resistance and achieving our goals? What do you think we need from the international community?
Well, I think it's important first continue with the solidarity. I think the people in Guatemala, they are fighting, they resisting, they are very creative to find ways to maintain the movement. And the international solidarity need to be there also to show in different ways, to write to the government, to support the groups that they try to do something from Guatemala and try to understand that this resistance and this movement is important not only for Guatemala, it's for the world, because right now the world we have a lot of problems. And this movement show us also that this is also very inspiring, that is, they made this protest in peace. They create the way to talk, the dialogue with the authorities, and stop the authorities to use the force. This is very important to show the people. They need to know more, and you need to be, the solidarity need to be open, no? That I feel this is important, no?
Yes, I agree with you. So we need to continue receiving the international accompaniment, support, and solidarity so that we could achieve our dreams of democratic society. And I agree with you that this is, that Guatemala is not the only case. We have so many other countries in conflict because of similar reasons. But in Guatemala, as you mentioned, it's very important to underline that people in resistance are peacefully demonstrating. So I thank you so much, Maritza, for giving us your time and your experiences about what's going on in Guatemala. I really hope that people get interested in the book written about you. I read it. It's really excellent and gives people an idea of what people go through when they are forced disappeared. Although in your situation, you were really, really lucky that there were international organizations that help you, and that's why you were able to be released. So that shows the importance of international solidarity. This program would not have been possible without the participation of Rosemary Wally, Martin Eloy, Maritza Urrutia, Sara Quirruchich, and our listeners. Since in the second half of the program, we talked about resistance and the leading actors are indigenous ancestral authorities from the Mayan nations, we are closing our emission with our last song, Resistir, to resist, by a Kakchikel singer and writer, Sara Kuruchich. Her song talks about not letting our light fade away, not letting our dreams die, keeping our hope, walking together, and sharing our love and life so that we can achieve our victory.
Que no se apague el amor, que no se apague. Vamos caminando, dejando huella, compartiendo miradas y estrellas, caminando, caminando por la vida.
Thank you. Good evening. You will hear two Amanda rebroadcasts tonight, the first from November 11th, 2020, and the second from 2022 last year. The first is a Remembrance Day commemoration, and the second is why Africa should be afraid of NATO's wars. Stay tuned to these rebroadcasts.
Good evening and welcome to Amanda here on CQT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Amanda is your 1 hour of African current affairs. And well, tonight it's kind of a solo show, actually, Doug. Thank you. You have put together a lovely lineup. Could you let us know what's in store for tonight?
Well, it is November 11th, and I've always sort of paid tribute on November 11th to the Second World War. I'm a child of the Second World War. I was born literally that many months that it takes after my dad got off the troop ship in July 1946. And so I grew up reading the comics all about war, the vilifying the Germans and the Japanese with all sorts of racist language. Oh my gosh, that racist language. It was so bad. And yet there was no reflection on